This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, Jeffrey Gettleman spends most of his time covering wars. Except, he says, they're not exactly wars. He calls them un-wars, conflicts where terror has become an end, not just a means. Gettleman covers 12 countries, including Kenya, Congo, Sudan, Ethiopia, and Somalia, which he describes as the most dangerous place in the world. He's won two Overseas Press Awards in 2003 for a story on a Pakistani boy who was kept as a sex slave in an Afghan prison, and in 2008 for reporting on human rights abuses in Ethiopia. In 2004, when he was reporting from Iraq, he was captured and held in Fallujah. We've been wanting to talk with Gettleman, and his current three-week visit in the U.S. has given us that opportunity. Before we start the interview, which I recorded earlier this week, I want to let you know that Gettleman gives some graphic and disturbing descriptions of atrocities he's reported on in the unwars. Jeffrey Gettleman, welcome to Fresh Air. If most of your time is spent covering unwars in Africa, how would you describe what an unwar is?
Well, what we're seeing across Africa today is many conflicts, internal conflicts, that have an absence of ideology. They're more criminally driven wars. From the reading I've done and compared to the liberation wars of yesteryear in Eritrea, in Zimbabwe, in Ethiopia, even in Angola, there were causes back then. And of course, there was criminality and there was violence and there was gratuitous bloodshed. But it seemed like these rebel movements actually stood for something. They had popular support. For example, in Eritrea, they had classrooms to teach people all sorts of things like literacy and numeracy. A big part of that liberation movement wasn't just to have a separate country, but it was to revolutionize society. And men and women fought on the front lines together, and the whole society was behind this liberation movement, was behind the rebel group. Today, it's totally different. A lot of these rebel organizations prey upon the people they're supposed to be liberating. If you look in Congo, there's dozens of so-called rebel groups, and they have absolutely no popular support. In Somalia, for instance, you have the Shabab rebel group that is fighting against the government and trying to overthrow the weak transitional government in Somalia. And these guys are widely reviled by the Somali population. They're trying to impose a harsh and alien form of Islam, and the people are chafing under their rule, and they have very, very little popular support.
So what we're seeing now is more like militias and warlords as opposed to liberation movements. So what do these warlords want?
Well, that's an interesting question. Sometimes it's not clear. Let's look at the LRA, which is a long-standing rebel group originally from Uganda. It's now terrorizing a wide swath of Central Africa, including Congo, Sudan, Central African Republic. They're even bumping up against the border of Chad. And this group is different from the liberation movements or rebel groups of yesteryear. For example, they don't want to take the capital. They don't want to take territory. They don't want to rule. They just want resources and they want to terrorize. And so the leader of the LRA is this very elusive fugitive figure named Joseph Kony. He's wanted by the International Criminal Court. He's been wanted for years. And it really seems senseless. The LRA moves through villages. They chop off people's lips. They kill civilians. I did a story a couple months ago about a horrible massacre in Congo where maybe 300 civilians were killed. It looked like it might have been part of a brutal recruitment campaign, but it wasn't really clear. And the LRA just moved through this arc in eastern Congo in a very sort of ungoverned, remote area, just hacking their way from village to village, and then they left. And what's the military objective of that? And there's an interesting tie-in to child soldiers here, that as these movements gravitate further and further away from having an ideological root, from having a real cause, there's basically no adults that want to join them. There's no reason to join them. So then they're left with trying to steal or kidnap or conscript children to fight their wars because no reasonable adult is going to join.
In describing some of the atrocities that the Lord's Resistance Army has committed, the army that you were just talking about, you met women who were mutilated. You met women whose lips were cut off by the LRA. How did they continue to function?
It's horrible. I was in Uganda a couple years ago, and we asked to speak to some victims of the LRA, and very quickly some elders assembled dozens of women who had been mutilated by these guys, and they live in horrible shame. They're unable to ever forget what happened to them. It's a situation where there's no answers for them. What do you do? I was just in Eastern Congo a couple months ago, and there had been a girl who had been kidnapped and had her lips cut off by the LRA, and she was sitting in this medical clinic in a very remote town. The few aid workers in the town were trying to figure out what to do because she needs help. She needs a plastic surgeon. She needs some way to restore her dignity, and she's living in one of the most cut-off parts of the world.
You've been describing the kind of sadism that African militias are responsible for. Do you have any sense of what unleashes this kind of sadism where people are doing this to their own people?
I think it's partly a function of very weak states, and that when you have these large ungoverned spaces in very poor countries, these things emerge and they take on an energy of their own. For example, the LRA, it started out in Uganda in the late 80s when the state was very weak. It hadn't been that long ago when Idi Amin had brutalized the country. There had been a lot of political turmoil. The current government was just beginning to get some traction, and there were large parts of the country that were still chaotic. And this movement was able to use that as first an excuse to exist and to fight against the government, but then as a way to spread and to operate because the government wasn't strong enough. We see the same thing in Eastern Congo. The collapse of that country, one of the biggest countries in the heart of Africa that borders something like 9 different African countries, this stunningly beautiful, lush, rugged place, and it is a basket case because the central government is so weak and the place has been so traumatized by a brutal colonial rule and then almost 30 years of very corrupt, very dysfunctional leadership under Mobutu, Zaire's former dictator. And that has left this immense country disconnected, isolated, not functioning in most places. And that's allowed these rebel groups to thrive. And one of the effects of this is horrible violence against women. Eastern Congo is considered the rape capital of the world. Hundreds of thousands of women have been raped in the jungles there. There really is no end. And it's just like Somalia or Sudan or what we're seeing in other parts of Congo, that as long as there's a very weak state government and as long as there is easy access to weapons. And Somalia is a great example. It's probably the modern world's longest-running example of a chaotic state with no central government. This is despite billions of dollars, enormous diplomatic attention, one peace effort after another. And 20 years later, the place is chaotic and violent and hopeless in many ways, as it was in 1991 when the government collapsed.
Okay, so you say that Somalia is like the example of the weak state, or in Somalia's case, no state virtually, and how that kind of unleashes this, can we describe it as gang warfare?
Yes and no. I mean, Somalia has been so chaotic and violent for so long. The warfare has evolved. It started out as battles between rival clans, and clan was always a very important part of Somali identity. And then it became almost ideological or religious-based, and that's what we're seeing today, where different groups adhere to different versions of Islam, and they're fighting against each other, and they have crossed clan lines, and you have this new sort of axis of conflict. But the problem is when you have these places that remain mired in this state of anarchy for that long, every day they're like that, it gets harder and harder to reimpose authority. And I've seen it with my own eyes. In Somalia, people adapt. They get used to the fact there's no central government. Businessmen start schools. Neighborhoods band together to provide their own generators. I even saw during one of my first visits to Mogadishu a privatized mailbox where you buy a stamp from some businessman, put it on a letter, stick it in a certain mailbox, and they come and deliver the mail. So people begin to get used to not having any government. And then you begin to have these vested interests that profit off the chaos. You know, for example, people that have taken over old government buildings and are renting them out, they don't want a new government to show up. Or people that are importing expired goods or not paying any taxes to bring things in and to sell them on the streets, they don't want a government. And then you have businessmen and other warlords that have gotten used to having their own independent power base purely by force. And they're worried that if there is a legitimate government, they're going to be held to account for all the horrible things they've done and they're going to be kicked out. So Somalia is a very obvious example, but what we see in eastern Congo and even in parts of Sudan begin to resemble it, which is if you have no government there for that long, it gets harder and harder to bring it back.
Al-Shabaab is the Islamist group, the radical Islamist group that's trying to take over Somalia and impose a very harsh form of Islamist law. What is their Islamist agenda?
Well, Al-Shabaab started out as a local group. It's not quite clear exactly when they formed, sometime around 2004, 2005, maybe 2006. But they got a lot of popular support in 2007 because the Ethiopian military was occupying Somalia and Al-Shabaab was spearheading the resistance to them. And a lot of people appreciated that. Since then, though, the Ethiopians have left. A moderate Islamist government, so to speak, has come to Somalia with the support of the United Nations and the U.S. And there's less of an obvious cause now for why Al-Shabaab is fighting. And one thing that they seem to be driven by is this global jihad mission, where they are attracting people from all corners of the planet to come to Somalia and fight for Islam. And we've seen a number of young American Somalis join their movement. Even non-Somali Americans have come, Western Europeans, people from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Chechnya. There's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of foreign fighters now that are the backbone of Al-Shabaab.
So among the laws that Al-Shabaab is trying to impose on Somalia are no music, no gold teeth, and no bras. I know no music has been applied in other Islamic states. I don't understand the no gold teeth and the no bras.
It's pretty confusing where they're getting this from. From what I've been told, that any evidence of the modern world is suspect. And I guess women weren't wearing bras in 7th century Arabia. Therefore, Al-Shabaab doesn't want women in Somalia in 2010 to wear bras. They've been pulling out gold teeth from people saying that that's un-Islamic. They're making men grow beards in some of the territory they now control. They have killed people for watching TV. They have stoned to death adulterers, and they've cut off hands of teenage thieves. I was in Mogadishu a couple months ago, and I did an interview with two boys who had their right hand cut off and their left foot because they had been accused of stealing cell phones. And it was this gruesome public amputation where they herded together hundreds of people. And there's not a lot going on in Somalia right now, and there's very little entertainment. There's very few public gatherings of any sort. So these people were sort of pushed together into this, you know, big dusty open field. These boys were brought out on gurneys. They were strapped down. And this one kid told me that one of the men who were operating, so to speak, on him had this huge knife with maybe a 10-inch blade. He said that the boy told me it was the kind of knife used to slaughter a camel. And two men pulled his arm really tight and squeezed down on his wrist, you know, so much that the boy screamed out in pain. And then they just started sawing through his wrist bones with this big knife. And he said it took like 10 minutes. And he fainted from the agony of it, and now he's left totally helpless. You know, no right hand, no left foot, oddity in a place where it's hard enough to make a living and survive. And he has to have this stigma of shame of having had this happen to him in public, and never really being able to move on from it.
What a really horrible description. And I guess this is an example of why you describe Somalia as the most dangerous place in the world.
Well, there's no green zone. There's no one part of Somalia that's safe. That's the problem. And some of these other countries like Iraq or Afghanistan, where I've worked, there are conflict areas, there are lawless places. But there is one part of the country that is somewhat stable, where if you needed help, you could get it. In Somalia, that doesn't really exist. You're on your own. The minute you land at the airport, you have to fill out a form that asks for your name, address, and caliber of weapon. And guns rule the place. That is the law. It's the business end of a machine gun.
We've been talking about Somalia, which you describe as the most dangerous place in the world. You've reported from there. You've been there, what, about a dozen times? You say you visited refugee camps, insurgent hideouts, mosques, schools, warlord dens, famished villages.
Let's not forget the pirates, too.
You've talked to one of the pirates who captured that American ship, right?
That's right. And I met a pirate boss in northern Somalia last year who had claimed to have captured 25 ships and was part of a secretive pirate group called the Corporation.
What explanation did he give you for why he's a pirate?
A lot of these guys say the same thing. They say they were fishermen minding their own business, and when the government collapsed, all of a sudden the waters of Somalia became a free-for-all. Big fishing ships from around the world came to pilfer the resources from their seas, so they had to take up arms to protect their coastline.
And do you think that's the genuine answer?
I think there's some validity to how it began, but it has quickly morphed into a pure criminal enterprise. And this guy, you know, was laughing about all the different ransoms he had secured and said that he had, you know, gotten millions of dollars. And a big question is, where's the money going? Because it's not like there are, you know, skyscrapers rising out of the desert in Somalia or these guys are driving around Bentleys. The person I talked to, his name was Abshir Boya, was dangerously thin, you know, maybe 6'4", 160 pounds. He was trying to hit me up for some money to buy him cigarettes. And I said, hey, wait, I thought you had just, you know, hijacked all these ships and have millions of dollars. And he's like, listen, we have to split it between, you know, a lot of people. We have guards and underlings and businessmen and, you know, a whole family networks to pay. And every time we get a big ransom, we divide it up and it disappears, you know, within days.
Do you think that was true?
I think it's true to some extent. I think – and he – this guy – a lot of these guys are very – you know, they're obviously street smart. And he was telling me – he hadn't been educated. And many of the pirates I've spoken to said, you know, they never went to school, just like a lot of children in Somalia today. But he was saying if you don't have any experience handling money, once you get it, you don't know what to do with it. And that seemed to make some sense to me.
So when you go to Somalia, you've written you hire 10 gunmen when you go to Somalia because you have to. Otherwise, you don't stand a chance. So how do you find gunmen? I mean, you're not going to go on Craigslist or Google for gunmen.
No. You have to work through contacts that you have. It's all based on trust because the amount that you pay these gunmen to guard you is way less than what they would get if they kidnapped you and then tried to ransom you back. And we've seen that. Several journalists have been kidnapped, sometimes by guards that were ostensibly working for them. And then it was this whole protracted drama where, you know, weeks went by and a lot of money changed hands. And then finally the journalists or aid workers were free. So it's a very trust-based society. In the absence of more formal institutions, everything is based on personal reputations. So if you're invited by the right person who says, I will guarantee your security, you are a guest of mine, if anything happens to you, I look stupid, that person then has a motivation to make sure nothing happens to you. And that's how we operate. So if we go to Mogadishu, we check in with the right authorities. We tell them what we want to do. They offer to give us some protection, a militia. We then work out a deal where we pay the guards a certain amount per day. We buy their food. We buy their khat, which is this leaf that Somalis chew that's slightly – it's like a slight upper that gives you a buzz or a high. And that's the only way to operate. And it's not great because if you walk into a refugee camp or you go meet with a pirate or you just want to kind of get a sense of daily life in a place like Mogadishu, you're constantly shadowed by this wall of gunmen behind you that are making sure nobody kidnaps you.
So has anything really bad happened to you in Somalia?
No, it hasn't. I've been lucky. The trips I make there are very focused. We try to minimize our time on the ground. There are some local journalists that have helped me immensely and have looked out for everything, including my life. So, no, I've been to Somalia more than a dozen times, maybe close to 20 or 30 times, and it's never easy, but it's always really, really interesting.
You wrote an amazing story recently about child soldiers in Somalia. And one of the things that made this story so interesting was that the child soldiers you were writing about weren't fighting for the warlords. They were fighting with the government. Now, granted, it's not a very stable government. It's not a very powerful government. But still, the child soldiers were being used by the government. Why is that so significant?
Well, because this government that's trying to rule Somalia is purely surviving on Western aid. If it weren't for the United States and the United Nations and the European Union, this government in Somalia would collapse probably within hours. And that's what a lot of people were very upset about, is that why is it that the UN, which has been on numerous passionate campaigns to get armies to demobilize children from their forces, why is it that that same UN is giving money to the Somali government, which is openly employing child soldiers? And the same for the United States. The United States has criticized many African rebel forces for kidnapping and conscripting children, like the LRA, which has made that its signature tactic. And yet at the same time, the American government is pumping millions of dollars and weapons into the Somali government, and they're openly employing child soldiers. We spent a couple days on the streets of Mogadishu and saw these kids working. One of them, a kid named Awil, looked like he was 10 or 11 years old. His commander thought maybe he was 12, and he was carrying a heavy AK-47 automatic rifle, searching cars and stopping cars, and he could barely see over the hood of these cars. And he was a tough little kid. He was addicted to cot. He smoked cigarettes. He looked like somebody you didn't want to tangle with. And we met many boys like that. One of them, a 15-year-old, had been shot in the arm, and he said that he had been sent to Uganda for training when he was 12 years old. And a lot of that training that's going on in Uganda is directly overseen by American military advisors. So it seemed like in the rush to stand up an army to protect this very weak, fragile government, the government was not discriminating, they weren't vetting, and they were basically grabbing anybody who could carry a gun, even though a lot of these kids could barely do that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in response to your article, the Somali government and the U.S. denied any knowledge of the government using child soldiers.
Well, the Somali government sent out a mixed signal. They said they were not knowingly using any child soldiers, but at the same time, they said that they would demobilize any children in their forces. The U.S. government had said officially, we are not aware of the Somali government doing this, yet unofficially, I had government officials telling me that they were aware this was a problem. They had been trying to convince the Somali government to stop this practice and that they were offering them help. And the same goes for UNICEF. UNICEF had told me that they had been, you know, they had very specific plans for the government to demobilize these kids, but the Somali government was too disorganized to respond to them.
So is the United States possibly going to be charged with any crime if it knowingly supports a government that is using child soldiers?
Well, I didn't know it at the time, but after I did the story, a couple senators in Washington complained to the State Department and said that there were actually American laws that may have been violated because there are certain provisions in Congress where the United States government is not supposed to give any resources to a military that uses child soldiers. So there's now calls for investigations in Washington and for a deeper look into this to see if any American money is actually going to pay child soldiers in Somalia.
So looking at Somalia a little bit more, you know, Somalia has been in a state of virtually no government or a very weak government for a long time. Is there anything that has worked that the international community has done to try to bring order to Somalia, as opposed to things that have backfired? I mean, where are we now in terms of intervention from other countries?
Well, it's a pretty discouraging track record. In the early 1990s, the U.S. sent this huge mission under the first President Bush and then under President Clinton that ended very disgracefully with the Black Hawk Down incident in 1993, where Somali militiamen in flip-flops with machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades shot down two American helicopters and killed a number of American servicemen. And after that, the U.S. got discouraged and basically pulled out tens of thousands of troops. That intervention was considered a failure. Since then, the U.N. has been involved to a lesser degree in trying to help the Somalis stand up a government, but none of it has really worked. And now there's a new dynamic, and that is that a lot of people worry that even if this government in Somalia, even if it's not very good, it's better than the alternative, which is a Somalia that is totally ruled by the Shabaab. However, people are beginning to challenge that conventional wisdom, and this new theory has emerged in the last couple months called constructive disengagement. And some people are saying that it's time for the international community to disengage from Somalia, that all their interference, all it's really done is made things worse. It's further radicalized the population. It's given a cause to some of these rebel groups that really didn't have a cause. So some people say maybe it's better for the Somalis just to fight it out among themselves. And yes, it will be bloody and it will get worse in the short term. But maybe in the long term, that's the only way to have a real durable reconciliation.
Does it look like the international community is headed toward that constructive disengagement?
I don't think people are ready to call it quits yet. But as the days go on when this government really doesn't do much, they're still holed up in this hilltop palace in central Mogadishu and trying to fight it out in these neighborhoods around there. They control very little territory. They don't deliver any services. They've been totally paralyzed in the last couple months by infighting for this post or that post. And these positions are more or less meaningless because the government really doesn't do much. So I think we're in a discouraging phase of support for the government, but we're not quite at the point yet where people are ready to totally give up.
Jeffrey, you also covered Iraq, and in 2004, you were captured in Fallujah, and your life was in jeopardy when you were captured. And that was in 2004, and ever since then, you've continued to cover war zones in Iraq and through Africa. So I'm wondering, what gives you the courage and the stamina to keep being in war zones in spite of the fact that you nearly lost your life in one of them?
It's not an easy question to answer, why you would put yourself through all that or put your family through that. In the part of the world that I work, there are fewer and fewer journalists that have the resources, that have the big media organizations that can back them up, that can spend the money, that can take these risks and report these stories. And if Somali journalists can't do it. It's too dangerous for them. They're under incredible pressures of their own. They're not free to write about what they want to write. One of the consequences of the child soldier story we did was the government was so outraged at our report that they were using child soldiers that they have threatened the local journalists that helped us report that story. And in some cases, some of the people that worked with us had to flee the country. And that's just an example of how difficult it is in many of these countries to illuminate what's happening.
But let me just ask you, in a situation like that, how do you weigh the fact that some people's lives are now at risk with the fact that you are able to expose a very, very important story about child soldiers?
I think it's a really tough balance to strike. You could use a utilitarian way of looking at it and say, well, we're helping more people by getting the word out, and it might endanger a few of us, but the greater good is served by exposing what's happening. And maybe these kids will be demobilized, and maybe other children in Somalia won't have to go through what these boys are going through that we interviewed. But it's very difficult. I was arrested in Ethiopia in 2007 and put in jail for a week with my wife, who was shooting video for the New York Times. It was a terrifying experience. All we were trying to do was to get to a part of the country where there's been serious allegations of human rights abuse, where the population is really under the thumb of the military. It's like a Darfur situation in that part of Ethiopia. And we were just trying to go there and put a spotlight on it. And we were branded as public enemies by the government of Ethiopia. And you get caught up in a sense of duty, and maybe that sounds too self-righteous, but you really begin to think that if you don't take these risks yourself, nobody's going to know what's happening in these places. And there's a lot of lives at stake, and there's horrible things that are going on every day. And if nobody wants to take the risk to go into these places, then nobody's ever going to know what's happening there.
Were you and your wife in the same cell in Ethiopia?
We were at the beginning, and then they split us up. And they at one point, they marched me out into the desert with a gun at my back and said, we'll do with you whatever we want. You have to tell us exactly who you talk to and why you're here and give us your sources and give us your information. And I said no. And it was terrifying. This, again, is an American ally that gets hundreds of millions of dollars each year and American taxpayer money. And the military there is accused of being horrendously brutal to its own people. And I got a little taste of that. These guys had, you know, they didn't care at all that I was a journalist for an American newspaper, that I had an American passport, that I had a legitimate visa. They didn't care about that at all. They kept us incommunicado for a week, transferred us from secret prison to secret prison, and gave us a taste of what really happens in a country like that.
Well, Jeffrey Gettleman, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations on all the excellent reporting you've been doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Gettleman is the East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's currently in the U.S. on a three-week visit. You'll find links to his recent stories about Somalia on our website, freshair.npr.org. In a new biography of the best-selling writer and Nobel laureate Pearl S. Buck, the author, Hilary Sperling, quotes a recent New York Times article on Buck that says, quote, "In China, Buck is admired but not read, and in America, she's read but not admired," unquote. Sperling is out to change that estimation of Buck. Here's book critic Maureen Corrigan's review of Pearl Buck in China.
Ever since her 1931 blockbuster, The Good Earth, earned her a Pulitzer Prize and eventually the first Nobel Prize for literature ever awarded to an American woman, Pearl S. Buck's reputation has made a strange, slow migration. These days, it's her life story rather than her novels, which are now barely read either in the West or in China, that's come to fascinate readers. The big shift was set in motion almost 15 years ago, when literary scholar Peter Kahn lifted Buck out of mid-cult obscurity in his monumental biography called simply Pearl S. Buck, A Cultural Biography. Now, award-winning biographer Hilary Sperling has made a case for a reappraisal of Buck's fiction as well as her life. Sperling claims that Buck had a magic power, possessed by all truly phenomenal best-selling authors, to tap directly into currents of memory and dream secreted deep within the popular imagination. Sperling's book is called Pearl Buck in China, and after reading it, I've been motivated to dust off my junior high copy of The Good Earth and move it to the top of my must-read-again-someday pile. Following Kahn's lead, Sperling further succeeds in making Buck herself a compelling figure, transforming her from dreary lady author into woman warrior. Sperling's biography focuses almost exclusively on Buck's Chinese childhood as the daughter of zealous Christian missionaries and young adulthood as the unhappy wife of an agricultural reformer based in an outlying area around Shanghai. Buck was born Pearl Comfort Seidenstricker in 1892, and from her earliest days was much more than a cultural tourist. She roamed freely around the Chinese countryside, where she would often come upon the remains of abandoned baby girls left for the village dogs, and she would bury them. Buck's first language was everyday Chinese, and she grew up listening to village gossip and reading Chinese popular novels like The Dream of the Red Chamber, which were considered sensational by intellectuals, as her own later novels would be. Buck's father, Absalom, was often away, traveling over his mission field, an area as big as Texas, preaching blood and thunder sermons to often hostile Chinese passersby. After the first 10 years he had spent in China, Sperling tells us, Absalom had made, by his own reckoning, 10 converts. The young buck and her family lived at subsistence level in houses that were little more than shacks and apartments on streets thronged with bars and bordellos. They managed to survive the Boxer Rebellion and the subsequent violence that heralded the advance of the Chinese nationalists. By the time she arrived as a charity student at Randolph-Macon Women's College in Virginia, Buck was indelibly alienated from her American counterparts. "Girls came in groups to stare at me," wrote Buck, remembering her first harsh college days some 50 years later. She was set apart not only by her out-of-date clothes made by a Chinese tailor, but by her extraordinary life experiences, which encompassed firsthand knowledge of war, infanticide, and sexual slavery. As Sperling deftly illustrates, that alienation gave Buck her stance as a writer, gracing her with the outsider vision needed to interpret one world to another. Buck's unconventional childhood also seems to have made her resistant to groupthink. In midlife, as a famous novelist, she made enemies criticizing the racism of the mission movement. She also shocked contemporaries by writing in her memoir, The Child Who Never Grew, about her brain-damaged daughter, Carol, at a time when such children were quietly institutionalized and publicly forgotten. Sperling quotes liberally from some of Buck's forgotten domestic novels, which defied the mores of her time by depicting sexual despair and revulsion within marriage. And finally, she earned herself no points with China's new leaders when she likened the zealotry of communism to that of her father and his missionary colleagues. Writing in 1954 about an encounter with a breathless Chinese communist woman, Buck said, "And in her words, too, I caught the old stink of condescension." Pearl Buck in China similarly rescues Buck and some of her best books from the stink of literary condescension and replaces that knee-jerk critical response with curiosity.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Pearl Buck in China, Journey to the Good Earth by Hilary Sperling. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. It's no surprise that this week's opening of the latest Twilight movie was boffo box office. It opened on more screens across the country than any other movie in history. Eclipse is the third Twilight movie adapted from Stephanie Meyer's series of best-selling books. Her stories mix modern vampires and werewolves with an old-fashioned gothic sense of romance and peril. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
At 9 p.m. on June 29th, I walked past hundreds, if not thousands, of mostly teenage girls in line for the first midnight showing of Eclipse in Times Square, and wondered what it was about the slow, old-fashioned, remarkably chaste Twilight saga that has mesmerized a generation of kids whose catchphrase is, "Whatever," among them my 12-year-old daughter. You have Bella, a remarkably inexpressive teenage virgin, a gentlemanly vampire, Edward, who's afraid to touch her for fear his bloodlust will take over and he'll gobble her up, and a Native American werewolf, Jacob, who doesn't have a prayer of landing Bella, but hovers protectively, showing off his six-pack abs and deltoids like a human muscle chart. In part, it's the trendy vampire fetish and the usual blockbuster hysteria. But most blockbusters don't move so glacially and withhold so much. Could it be that kids are actually thrilled for once to defer their gratification? Speculation aside, Eclipse is on its own terms quite good. I'm grading on a curve. The last one, New Moon, almost put me in a coma. But the new director, David Slade, has more of a handle on the measured tempo, and the screenplay mixes those long, lovelorn dialogues with nifty historical flashbacks and lots of hissing vampire villains. We're back in Forks, on the coast of Washington State, where Kristen Stewart's Bella and Robert Pattinson's Edward are stretched out in a meadow of soft-focus violets. Edward asks her once again to be his bride, and Bella stares at her lap and twists her wide mouth on her long jaw and refuses to give him a firm yes or no until he promises to kill and resurrect her as a vampire so they can be together forever. She also wants to make love before she's a vampire, so she'll know what it's like, quote, while I'm still me. Edward, however, is old-fashioned, having come of age a century earlier. He believes they must wait until they're married before they have sex and he kills her. As you can guess, his pure-mindedness puts a strain on the relationship, especially with that werewolf at the door. Also, there's this red-headed vampire woman, played in this film by Bryce Dallas Howard, who wants Bella's scalp, or neck, or something. After Edward whisked Bella off to Florida, not the best place for a sun-shy vampire, the couple bump into Taylor Lautner's Jacob in front of their high school.
Hey.
Charlie said you left town.
Yeah, to visit my mom. Why?
He's checking to see if you're still human. Look, I'm here to warn you. If your kind come on our land again.
You should leave. Now.
She has a right to know. She is the one the redhead wants.
Victoria? Alice's vision.
I was trying to protect you.
By lying to me. You. Why haven't you called me back?
I had nothing to say.
Well, I have tons. Hold on.
Hey, Bella.
Edward, you have to trust me.
I do trust you. It's him I don't trust.
Sexual tension, pregnant pauses, that's Eclipse. Except I hasten to add, the actors are very good looking. And there are maybe 500 lengthy, monumental, screen-filling close-ups of them. Around the 200th, I became hypnotized by their flawless complexions. Was their skin tone evened out in post-production? Did computers squeegee out their zits? Pattinson comes out worse than Lautner in this one. His Edward hangs back, looking clingy and vaguely antiseptic. But the two have a good, tense, cards-on-the-table dialogue that had me thinking, oh, why don't you macho men kiss already? Kristen Stewart can seem sullen, a little dull, but I like her. She seems temperamentally averse to emoting. She's an anti-drama queen. Given how florid this material is, I think she's smart to hold something back, to let the audience project their own feelings onto her face. Eclipse's principal threat is an army of vicious newborn vampires, which means the upright vampires and righteous werewolves, normally antagonists, have to team up against their common enemy. The Big Rumble is a hash of smash cuts and computer-generated imagery, but it's surprisingly cathartic after all those tortured silences. My ideal battle scene would have more splatter, but these vampires apparently don't bleed. As my 12-year-old daughter explained, vampires don't have any blood. That's why they need to keep drinking it. I said I'd been watching vampire movies for 45 years, and they sure as hell had plenty of blood until now. And she said what I already knew in my bones. Dad, these are not your vampires.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Eclipse. And while we're on the subject of vampires, we'll close with the theme from HBO series True Blood. The theme was written and sung by Jace Everett. The album that it's featured on, Jace Everett's Red Revelations, was re-released last month.
When you came in, the air went out. And every shadow filled up with doubt. I don't know who you think you are, but before the night is through, I wanna do bad things with you. I'm the cat who sits.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
I want to do bad things with you. Okay. The air went out, and all those shadows there filled up with doubt. I don't know who you think you are, but before the night is through, I wanna do bad things with you.